This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. I've had the same tailor in New York City for years, which I know is a sentence that sounds extremely twee, but let me clarify. I'm not talking about an Anderson and Shepherd-y royal appointment, Savile Row kind of thing. I'm talking about a place that will shorten sleeves properly, fix moth holes, and figure out how to let out the waste of a pair of expensive pants without making a lot of judgmental side comments. Because, you know, if like me, you occasionally are defenseless against the breadbasket in restaurants, you often have to get your clothes adjusted to reflect the new reality of whatever it is you're carrying around now, thanks to airport Cinnabons. Or maybe, like me, you occasionally mount fortifications against your true nature and you declare that for you, bread is over. Like, I don't even miss it. I don't even miss pasta. In which case, you need a tailor for that happy and, for me, temporary triumph. And the best tailor is one who speaks a complicated foreign language, one in which the words, "Look at what happened to that guy," and "We're going to need stronger thread," and "Yo-yo dieters like this guy end up having massive heart attacks," right? All those unintelligible to you. Just sounds like gibberish as they measure you up. Hong Kong Tailor Jack was exactly that place. It was a shabby storefront in an old building in Greenwich Village, actually owned by a man named Jack from Hong Kong, and he had the perpetually sad expression and papery skin of somebody who lit his first cigarette in 1962 and has been smoking continuously since then. But he also knew how to fix the cuff of a blazer from the shoulder, how to politely point out when there was no more material left to let out the pair of trousers. In other words, he was a master tailor. A little while ago, I walked into Hong Kong Tailor Jack, and I was greeted by the usual noisy Cantonese and the smell of soup, and I could hear the sewing machines going on in the back room, and I asked for Jack, and the mostly Cantonese-only speaking guy behind the counter, he made this gesture. He put his hands together, like, as in prayer, and then he put them both up against the side of his face, and he closed his eyes. "Is he taking a nap?" I asked. "No, no," was the reply. "He died." "Well, gosh, I'm sorry to hear that," I said, which was interpreted by the guy as my saying, "Well, I guess I'll have to go somewhere else." So then he said, in a heavy Cantonese accent, which I won't try to reproduce because it's racist, "No, no, no, it's okay. Jack didn't do much anyway. I mean, he was old. It's the people back there," he said, gesturing to the back room with the sewing machines and the Cantonese chit-chat. "They did it all, and they're still here, still the same. So you want us to let those pants out again?" Which, you know, I did, but also just felt different. Over the next few months, the place was remodeled and spruced up, and here's the real word for it, relaunched. A couple of younger women showed up with Americanized accents. Not American enough that imitating them wouldn't be racist, but it wouldn't be an automatic cancellation if I did. And also the smell of soup and cigarettes faded. Even Jack's widow disappeared. She, by the way, in the kind of flinty lack of sentiment prevalent among small business owners, was standing right behind the guy while he was telling me that Jack didn't do any of the real work anyway. And she was nodding and agreeing and saying over and over again, very sick, better now," all in a heavy Cantonese accent, which I, again, won't try to reproduce because it is definitely racist. Now, the only person with a lump in his throat, it turned out, was me, because I missed Jack. I missed the way he kept a dozen pins in his mouth. I missed the way he marked up my clothes with bits of soap. I even missed the way he looked at me when I'd walk out of the changing room, squeezed into a pair of trousers, and he'd shake his head, and I know he was thinking, too tight, but he'd just get right to work. It's a better business these days. It's faster, easier to communicate with the staff, open into the evenings. And when you get your clothes back, they don't smell like cigarette smoke. The sign above the door doesn't say Hong Kong Tailor Jack anymore. It's just Hong Kong Tailor now. The Jack part, that's gone. Although, apparently, according to everybody, he didn't do much anyway. But it shows you that sometimes the old idiosyncratic way a business has of running may actually be easy to replace. May not be missed by the employees. May be mourned only by the customer, you know, who liked a little unpredictable cigarette-stained weirdness. I guess what I mean is Hong Kong Tailor, it's a great place to get your clothes altered. Hong Kong Tailor Jack, that was a great TV show. Which is maybe why I'm basically sanguine about what some people are calling a big threat to the entertainment business, AI. Here's what I mean. I have a friend who is a very successful DJ, which probably gives you the impression that I'm the kind of person who knows a lot of DJs, but the truth is I only know one. And I once suggested that AI could probably replace her job in a few months. AI, I said, could measure the tone and quality of the sound of a room, the ambient noise, glasses clinking, the sound of feet on the dance floor. It could also maybe make a solid estimate about the relative age of the crowd and detect the way it was reacting to certain songs from certain eras. You could also give it real-time access to the till, which would enable it to measure the amount of alcohol being ordered and consumed, the number of high-end credit cards in use, that sort of thing. And all from that, it could generate a playlist updated and adjusted every second. And that was when she suggested that AI might have a better track record than I do of keeping a comedy on the air, which, you know, was mean, but probably deserved. Both of us, in other words, are quite possibly Hong Kong Taylor Jack. Replaceable, but not without losing the art of, I don't know, surprise. Because that really is what people in show business, creative people anyway, have or are supposed to have in their work. Spontaneity and surprise. In other words, we have only one foundational guideline in the entertainment industry, and that is we cannot be boring. I mean, we can get away with being weird, confusing, all sorts of things, and people will still watch our stuff, and some people will even claim to love it. But if we are boring, that's it. The thumb presses a button, and the screen is directed to somebody else's show, and another person in show business gets a shot at that viewer's attention. And that's one reason why I think everyone is missing the real story with the latest AI scandal about the new Google AI engine Gemini being too woke or too engineered to deliver left-wing propaganda. I mean, yeah, maybe, sure, whatever. It doesn't matter. I evaluate Gemini the way I evaluate everything. Is it good for me or bad for me? Is it going to make it harder for me to make a living or easier? And the truth is, the most striking aspect of the Gemini disaster isn't the political slant of the product. It's how boring it is, how tedious and uninteresting the answers are. And I'm pretty sure that you could say the same thing if there was such a thing as, I don't know, MAGA AI, which there probably will be. And it will be just as boring and predictable, which are two things we're not supposed to be in show business. Okay, once a long time ago, a joke in a script fell flat. This happens every now and then, of course. Well, more than every now and then. But the key is fixing it. And when you're in production and you've got a few rewrites ahead of you, a joke falls flat on the run-through, you try to come up with something better, but you got a week to fix it. But if you're in the middle of shooting a show and there's an audience there and a camera and an entire production unit, the smart thing to do is just nothing. You just move on. Because if you're really smart, you always produce a show that's a bit long. You always shoot a little more than you need so you can cut the stuff that doesn't work. And as everybody knows, cutting is a lot easier than fixing. But one time, we weren't long, and a joke fell flat on shoot night, and a bunch of the writers gathered in a corner as the audience and crew and cast waited patiently for us to come up with a better line. Now, okay, the joke was pretty simple. Parents have come for a surprise visit to their daughter. They're worried about her, and the setup was, "We were very disturbed to get your last phone call." And then she says, "Why?" And then they say, well, I can't remember what they said, but whatever it was, it didn't work. So we gathered in our circle and we started pitching new punchlines. Now, the best way to pitch a new line is to say the whole joke, setup and all, and then add in your pitch. So there were maybe 8 or 10 writers in a circle all murmuring, "We were very disturbed to get your phone call. Why?" And then they pitch their joke. "We were very disturbed to get your phone call. Why?" And then they pitch their joke. "We were very disturbed to get your phone call. Why?" And then they pitch the joke. And one writer pitched the following. "We were very disturbed to get your phone call. Why?" "Because we don't have a phone." Which, you know, doesn't make any sense, but kind of made us all laugh. Silly non sequiturs almost always do that. But unfortunately, everybody saw us laugh. The actors and the crew and the director and the audience. And they all thought, "Oh, hey, they got one." And I think the warm-up guy even said into the microphone for the audience, "Well, it looks like the writers have come up with a terrific joke to replace the last one that didn't quite work. Let's listen and see what they came up with." So, you know, we had a shrug sheepishly and wave everybody off and come up with something else, something that was both funny and that made at least some sense. Then that took a while. But the truth is, sometimes it's just best to go for the funny wherever you find it. Neil Simon, you know, pretty funny guy, he had a character in his play, The Sunshine Boys, explain that the funniest words in English were K words, words that had a hard K sound in there somewhere. And he's right, Ks are funny. Ls, for some reason, not so much. So there are funny sounds, and there are also funny rhythms. That same writer, the one who pitched "We Don't Have a Phone," he once walked into the writer's room and said, "Good Lord, it smells like Nell Carter's summer home in here." Now, I have no idea if the late Broadway and television star Nell Carter had a summer home, or if she did, what it smelled like. But for some reason, the cadence of the line, and of course the K sound in Carter, just made us all laugh. You couldn't predict it. No AI could come up with it. My current all-purpose favorite is Cinnabon. which is almost always funny, no matter where you put it, despite having no K sound at all. I mean, I used it a moment ago, maybe you noticed. It's a good all-purpose joke word. You know, try it yourself. If today or tomorrow you're stuck on a joke or just want to say something funny, stick a Cinnabon in there. It's easier than writing a new joke, let me tell you. In fact, to prove it to myself, I asked Gemini why Cinnabon is a funny word. And this is what it said. While Cinnabon isn't inherently funny, some people find it humorous for a few reasons. It's a pun. The word Cinnabon combines cinnamon and bun, creating a playful and slightly silly name for the bakery chain. Puns can be funny to some due to their wordplay and unexpected combination of sounds and meanings. It sounds whimsical. The name Cinnabon has a sing-songy quality with its repeated on sounds, making it sound lighthearted and somewhat silly. This whimsical tone can be perceived as humorous by some. It's associated with indulgence. Cinnabon is known for its rich, decadent cinnamon rolls, which can be seen as a guilty pleasure. The playful name might add to the lightheartedness of indulging in such a treat. But it's important to note that humor is subjective, and not everyone will find Cinnabon funny. However, the reasons mentioned above can explain why some people might perceive it as humorous. Yeah, okay. And then I asked, what did Nell Carter's summer home smell like? And it answered this way. Unfortunately, as there's no publicly available information about Nell Carter's summer home and its specific scent, it's impossible to definitively answer what it smelled like. However, we can use some creative thinking to imagine its potential scents based on various factors. Location. If the summer house was near the beach, there might be a faint, salty ocean breeze carrying the smell of seaweed and sand. If it was located in a forest, the scent of pine needles and earth might dominate. Personal preferences. Nell Carter might have enjoyed specific scents like fresh flowers, vanilla candles, or even the aroma of freshly baked goods. These personal preferences could have influenced the overall scent of the house. Activities. Activities like cooking, gardening, or burning wood in a fireplace could leave their own unique traces in the air. Ultimately, though, the true scent of Nell Carter's summer house remains a delightful mystery left to our own collective imagination. You know, for now, anyway, my job is pretty safe. I'm not a Hong Kong Taylor Jack about to happen. I can't say the same for my DJ friend, but that's just something she's going to have to discover on her own. And that's it for this week. Next week, we will go to church. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long with Martini Shot.